tuned in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
All right, it's great to be here for what I think could only be called a special edition of Origins, broadcasting from the Line Hotel here in beautiful Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. We have in the friendly confines of the studio here a culinary legend, and I don't think I'm exaggerating in the least when I say that. And if my voice is cracking a little bit, so be it. I'm joined today by Daniel Ballou, who is an inspiration to a lot of us who've been cooking for our lives, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Spike.
It's great to have you here. Great to have you in DC. How's the restaurant here going?
Ça va bien. Yeah. No, it's it's summertime, so summertime in DC sometime could be a little more tame, but overall I love DC. I've arrived in D.C. When I came to America. I started in D.C. Different dining scene, for sure, at the time. And but Jean-Louis Paladin was the master of the town.
Yes.
He was just amazing as a chef, and certainly precursor of when I see, this 20-seat restaurant with dining counters, or the interaction of the chef and the customers, and Jean-Louis was very much about that.
He anticipated a lot of the things that we now.
Oh yeah, and he was writing his menu at 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yes,
and maybe at 5:30, still changing things on it before he gave it to you at 7 o'clock.
I remember that handwritten menu with his.
Oh, amazing!
And I'm really glad you brought that up, because that's exactly where I want to start, which is the moment that you get to this country.
Mm-hmm.
And, as I understand it, I'd love to hear you walk us through this, but you spend your formative years cooking in France.
Yes.
And it so happens you end up in the kitchens of Verger and
Gérard
and Georges Blanc.
Mm-hmm.
And then you make your way after some time in Denmark and back in France. Here you are. And but you, as you said, you arrive, aside from Jean-Louis, to a very different kind of culinary scene, especially the French restaurants in this country haven't quite evolved and aren't cooking the food that you are cooking, right, in a way?
And also they were the old generation of chef who came maybe with the cruise ship or like in New York, for example, with the World Fair.
Yes.
And started this entire sort of generation of new restaurateurs because, they came sent by the French government to represent the French pavilion in the World Fair in New York, and they never went back to France.
Right.
They all stay there.
And they carried on cooking the food.
Legally or illegally,
right,
but at least. and they started to pop restaurant everywhere. And this was bleeding all over the country. So, suddenly, you had in D.C., for example, you had Jean-Pierre, and you had many other very classic
Chez Jean-Pierre. Like Lion d'Or and
Lion d'Or,
Maison Blanc.
Voilà, exactly.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And
those were kind of old-fashioned type of restaurant. And then there was Jean-Louis, who really came from not my generation, because he was older, but where it really was instrumental to the nouvelle cuisine in France and the revolution in cuisine. And he brought that here, and that was a real novelty. I mean, I remember Jean-Louis being so obsessed about the ingredient and how he felt, and we got to find everything I want. He was basically obsessed about making sure that this region and this country could give him what he left in France. And I think he worked so hard at having, an ex-lawyer raising squab in Virginia, because he taught him how to do it,
right,
and how to raise them and how to feed them,
yes,
and how to, and all kind of things like this, and finding, baby eels in Maine and serving lamprey and all ingredients which no one had that in their table before.
I don't think we still don't see a lot of lamprey around.
Have you had lamprey?
No, yet? I have. How is it?
In America?
No.
Well, I mean, with Jean-Louis, he will make this stew of lamprey where lamprey, I mean, you know, we eat eels, but lamprey is pretty ugly fish uh-huh. who suck blood
right.
of other fish.
Right.
And you make a sauce with the blood.
And it's got a specific name, right? That dish or not?
Wait, it's a matelote.
Matelote, yeah, right, exactly. So you're in New York, and what is it like to kind of, in a sense, are you carrying the expectations of kind of this new generation when you finally settle in New York?
No, but first in D.C. I came as a private chef uh-huh. because that was the opportunity to come to this country. And it was also an opportunity to work in an embassy. And I don't know, I was this morning while I was getting ready on PBS was a show about the 80s in D.C., and suddenly I had all these flashbacks about those rock clubs and about me in D.C. in 1982-81 and how bad it was and how tough it was.
Yeah.
And but how exciting it was because the food, something was happening with food here. And and as a chef, I had and they were talking about the Washington Star, the second paper of D.C., uh-huh. which they closed in 82, I think. But I managed to get a big article in the Washington Star then at the time. And I was here only for a year. And I felt like, wow, they are paying attention uh-huh. to me.
Who would have guessed? But great things happen. And it struck me to ask you this, and I don't know where this will land, but it's certainly part of our current conversation. Do you consider yourself an immigrant?
Yes. I'm still an immigrant, yeah. My children are American.
Uh-huh.
My wife is American, but I'm still French.
Still French, but... And here's the thought I had after that, which is...
But that means, beside that, I think... Deeply in my heart, I've been living longer in this country than in France. And I think when I'm in America, I'm American. But as soon as my mind wander, I'll just go back to France.
Back to France. And you're someone, I think, whose immigrant story differs a little bit because you arrive here and you make your way and you get established. And in a relatively short amount of time, I'm sure you're learning about what's going on here, but you also start to change our dining culture and our restaurant culture and by extension, our food culture. And I think, you know, that's where this story picks up a lot of steam. Mm-hmm. And I go back, I wanted to share with you the fact that I've done one and only one stage in my life. When I was finding my way as a chef, I only got to do one stage and it was at Le Cirque.
Oh my God, you did.
That was my one day. And I went up and I had... no idea what I was doing. No business being in your kitchen where you were the chef and Jacques Torres was the pastry chef.
Yeah, oh my God. So that was the early... Yeah, well, yeah, that was...
yeah, he was still uh-huh. there. And it was an amazing place. And Sota Kun was your...
Which I spoke to yesterday. Cambodian-French
yes.
chef. Who...
He was there. And I, for some reason that I will never understand, wore open-toed shoes of some kind. And you yelled at me because I was wearing the wrong shoes. Totally, you were completely right. And... that was my, that was my one and only stage.
Well, I'm sure then I was fearing for danger for your toes.
And you were. Felt like, you said, yes, you know, exactly maybe. What you were. You said, somebody spills something on you and you'll jump to the ceiling. And you're right. But I had a great time, learned a ton, was inspired by every single person I met there, including you. And that's obviously an experience that stayed with me. And I wanted to share another one. And this is a really happy experience that I had. I just want to kind of paint this picture. I was in New York for a Star Chefs event, and I think you had mm-hmm. actually presented that year with your entire team. It was incredible.
Yes.
From each restaurant prepared, I think, a dish based on a piece of pork.
Yes.
It was amazing.
I remember, yeah.
And you were kind of the ringleader.
Right.
And you let each of your chefs kind of
do their things. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so I had my business partner, my now business partner, Corey. We were walking back from that, and we walked by Danielle. And I said, you know, that's Danielle. That's right there. That's the place. And he's younger than me, and he was like, really? That's it? And I was like, yeah, let's go take a look. And we walked in, and we weren't dressed even as nice as a polo shirt. And I said, can we have a drink to the host? And she got up from her behind, there's a desk there, right?
Desk, yeah. Uh-huh.
And she gets up and she looked over just to make sure we weren't wearing flip-flops. And they sat us in the lounge and we started with a drink and the captain there was amazing. And we said, let's have a bite to eat. And then we kept asking questions and he says, I propose a menu. And he nailed the menu and we had a half bottle of wine and it was perfection. And then I look across the room and I see you in your you've just put on your whites. And I say to Corey, who's got his back to me, his back to you, like you do. I said, look out. It's happening. And I see him talking to our captain. And you come over to the table and you're like, you have this incredible way of asking what we're up to. And we were at Star Chefs. And you're like, get these guys a drink. And then I'm taking them on a tour of the kitchen. And we go back into the kitchen of Danielle. And it is just, to me, to this day, it feels like the epicenter of all things culinary. It was so intense, and it feels like it's like on multiple levels. And, you know, all the faces turned to face us, and I just felt like it was...
Sweet. I wish I could remember the moment, but I'm glad you do.
I know you've had millions of moments like this, I'm going to get to a point here in a second. But and we got back to the table, and in the meantime, they printed a menu with what we had on it. And it was one of the most spectacular evenings that I've had that I was able to share with a friend, and it obviously made this incredible lasting impression on me. And I just want to ask you, how did you do that?
I don't know. I chose this business because I feel I love hospitality and I love to make people happy, take care of people, And I think for me, of course, I grew up I had the chance to learn as a chef, to work with some of the finest restaurateurs and chefs in the world, I would say, because I think in France, they were kind of leading at that time what maybe excellence was about. But then, you know, what I don't like sometimes is to have to carry formality in order to protect reputation, but you need to put a little bit of order and discipline into a business. And if you choose to be a fine dining, you have to kind of respect the customer who choose to come to a fine dining restaurant. And so to say, then you came with you not sneakers maybe, but you know,
not
raggy shirts.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah,
I mean, basically, you look like a cook. That's okay. And and we can see them coming through the door.
Yeah.
And right away, I mean, I am so good at telling the maître d', you know, sometimes it will take the manager or the maître d' 2 hours to find out who is at the table, and it'll take me only 10 seconds just by, you know, giving a reading of the person. And I know that they're in the business. I know they're cooks or they're definitely in the business. And I'm glad that we welcome you and we didn't say, well, sorry, you don't belong here. You don't have your jacket and tie or something.
I have an even better story about but, that relates to that. Uh-huh. But I'll save that. But I will say that...
But I mean, to me, I think at the end, it's about food. And today, Danielle, compared to today, to Danielle 10 years ago and 20 years ago, and this year we're celebrating 25th anniversary. And it keep changing. It keep evolving. It keep... I mean, we keep raising the bar there, and I think it's a little different today than it was, because we try to be even more. I think we try to be even more cautious. And
what do you mean by cautious?
Cautious in the sense that, you know, we used to do maybe more cover, and we weren't charging enough and doing more cover. But now I think I prefer to charge more and do less. And really do, I mean, to keep, you know, raising our ambition and our service, our attention to detail, and just having a restaurant who is worth the journey. And
as they say in the Michelin Guide.
Exactly.
Right.
And I think I know what it is. I just didn't feel that I wanted to go there before. And I think today, more than ever, I think I'm very happy going there.
I will say that there's something that I've never not had that experience, some version of that experience that I just shared at your places.
Uh-huh.
Never not had it. There's always something. And even last night, I ran into you downtown, and I was having the best time, and I connected with the waiter, who turns out he knows the same farmer that I know in Pennsylvania.
Oh, really?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, my God.
It always happens when I'm in your places. And I just, there's something there that not everyone can lay claim to. And you, I mean, the food is always spectacular, but there's something else going on there that I'm determined to find out what it is, because it's very, very rare.
Well, I want to make sure then, and that's maybe the hardest thing in a business to translate is how well are you able to represent me, an individual working for me, either by your talent as a cook or your talent as a host. We try to work hard at making sure they understand where I come from, what I stand for, and what I will do when someone is in the restaurant coming to. And it's not meant that every customer who come to a restaurant know who is the chef and who run this place and what. I mean, but at least it's our job to make sure that if an individual came for a particular reason, which is that he knows the chef and he wanted to have a good time and feel some real sense of hospitality and soul and taste, and then we have to make sure that we can help that guest get to the point, to the experience of that.
And I want to maybe take that a little further and ask you, maybe in a broad sense, you know, you're talking about, you know, what it is the chef stands for, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what you think we kind of owe to our food, and or what is our responsibility to food? Is that a
well? We have huge responsibility to food, to how much we need to know the traceability, how much we need to have a trust within our suppliers, a trust within with anyone involved with the chain of bringing food to us. But also, I mean, I was born and raised on the farm, and to this day, my parents still stun me with their ability to transform anything with and do something out of anything. And I know that today in America, it's a battle which keep going on, and it's very important to keep that battle going on about, you know, either food waste or traceability of food or geo sort of location. I mean, every chef. And I think you are a master at making sure that you have a focus on the region and the bounty of this region. But it's not easy to be able to do that everywhere. And it's not easy. I mean, I have a restaurant in Florida. We try very hard to make sure we have local farmers there. And we do have. And they are great. But that's not enough. You know, our eggplants may have to come from California.
Right.
Zucchini may have to come from some other places. Certain things don't grow well. Certain things grow very well.
That's tough in Florida.
We serve corn in December there and wonderful tomatoes, which in New York were like corn.
Right.
So it's, I think seasonality and location has a lot to do with, and I think it's the chef himself. And that's why we started with Jean-Louis, because Jean-Louis was obsessed about ingredient, and the last thing he wanted was to try to bring ingredient from France to do his cooking. And I think to me, the message is there is like, you know, how much, and that's what we try to do in New York as well. We are very lucky in New York, actually, because we have at least 5 states around New York producing us amazing, amazing food. And you know, I don't mind if the food come at 200 miles away, but at least it's, to us, is kind of local. It's they come to the town. I mean, we have farmers from Vermont who come once a week and will buy and sell what they give us. And then, you know, if on Saturday there is no more of that lamb or whatever, then we'll have, you know. But there's and that I think is the foundation of a lot of what we do. Very seasonal menu and all that, which help also being more responsible with the menus and the food.
You've been a visionary for a long time, and I wanted to ask you about something you were involved with, Spice.
Yes.
And wondered if you'd be interested in talking about where you see the role of automation and tech and the intersection with cooking and food.
Well, I think we all know chefs, and evolution in technology into the kitchen has done a lot of help to the chef. I mean, today when you have an oven where you can pre-program and be so precise and consistent in what you do with it, it don't matter if it's at very low temperature or at very high, if it's with a multi-combination of steam and dry and whatever it is, I think precision and consistency come from, I think, support of technology.
Uh-huh.
And I think those four kids from MIT who came to me and say, you know, I've always respected you as a chef and all that, and we have created as a project for our graduation in MIT, we have created this robotic kitchen, and we would like to show you what it is if you're interested. And of course I was, and I went to Boston and they made me a couple of bowls. And that was a makeshift machine with plywood and all kind of recoup of equipment. Uh-huh. They fabricated something with wires and tape and plywood, but it worked. And I felt that there was something very unique and something who, just the way a chef is looking for that tool was going to help him become better while not replacing his job.
Right.
I felt that for the fast casual, this tool could really help in a segment of, let's say, the food is either pre-prepared or pre-cut or pre-seasoned, and then the machine will just do the stir-fry, the toss,
right.
but measure it precisely and at high speed and don't have to take a break or don't have to do anything. And then after, there's the service aspect where the bowl is done. You have chosen what you like, if you are vegetarian, vegan, or if you like chicken or any other protein and grains. And then the bowl is done, and then they finish it with toppings as well. And then there's the interaction with the guest about what else they like to have on their bowls and all that. And this is, it's affordable, it's precise, it's consistent, and I felt that they were on the right track with evolution in fast casual. Is then if technology can give a better price because you can afford to have better ingredient, mm-hmm. At the end it's a counter, it's a positive sort of counterbalance. Then, you know, of course, everybody think robot will replace human. No, it's not true. But at least if a robotic kitchen can give you a better access to better ingredients,
yes,
for fast casual, that's the key. And it's fun. And Spice is in Boston, downtown by Washington Street. And only one unit. And they work very hard there, everyone. And they're wonderful. And I think the model is everybody feels and there's something new and interesting within the fast casual. So we'll see where Spice will be in the future.
How's the food?
The food is great because it's very healthy, extremely healthy, sampled, well-seasoned, and always with sort of with sort of a seasoning calling for maybe a cuisine or a region, Mediterranean, uh-huh. or North African or Spanish or Mexican. So it's interesting.
So I want to change directions completely. I want to ask you this question, and I can't think of a better person to ask. Why is mustard so delicious?
Mustard?
Mustard.
Because I'm French. I mean, you are Nordic. I mean, Nordic love their mustard, but they put a little too much sugar sometimes in it.
Right.
But mustard is delicious because it's a condiment who just don't... It never overpower, but it definitely help either cut fat or it help just cut smokiness or cut... And give you... I mean, first, it's more healthy than ketchup.
Right. Or mayonnaise.
Or mayonnaise. And so it's healthy. It's it's spicy, it's vinegary, it's predictable, but in a way, then, you know, you don't pull mustard out of your fridge for breakfast. You don't pull mustard out of your fridge for... But mustard, it's definitely used as a savory condiment. And as a French, it can be just as simple as a steak frites, for example. Without the mustard, I'm not eating my steak
frites.
Right. Dijon mustard.
I actually had that moment last night at your place, and I was just like, I had mustard, and I was just like, why is this so good? I'm going to ask Danielle tomorrow. I'm going to find
and,
out.
And I think the evolution of mustard. So after that, of course, there is interesting mustard, such as the mustard made with the must of wine, of grape, the mustard with tarragon, the mustard with... And then there's honey mustard. I don't know who came up with honey mustard.
It's definitely an American thing. It's got to be.
I don't know. Yeah, well, if it's German or American.
Maybe, yeah.
I like also sometimes... I mean, I lived in Denmark, and your origin is Norwegian, mm-hmm. and you understand those hot dog stand in the street... And where they have all kind of mustard
yes.
and pickles and
it makes I love the that. Yes, me too. I guess there's one thing getting to talk to you like this and having been in your places over the years and seeing, you know, what you do and then reading about you working with spice. There's something that to me is consistent for you. And I wanted to bring that up and see what you thought about this, which is your to this day, unbridled curiosity. You know, we were standing out at the cup and having coffee, and you were talking to people that were walking up to you, and they always walk up to you. And in a moment, you're asking them where they're from or what they've been up to or where did you cook before? Mm-hmm. It seems to me that it fuels a lot of what you do, how you've gotten to where you are. And maybe...
Well, I think I've been blessed because I would have not stayed in this country if it didn't make me happy. And what made me happy, I think, is the young generation of chefs here. Of course, the customer made me secure and made me motivated. But I think happiness comes from the team and the suppliers. I think the two and what we can do together. And I think young people, I mean, I have children, and I am fascinated by their background, by where they come from, and their path a little bit, and see how they kind of like maneuver in life, and did they lean on things to be able to grow? Because I think it's very important as a young person to always lean on something, which is either your mentor or your family, or your friend, or I mean, you got to find sort of stability in every step you go up. And for me, that's how I grew up as a young chef. Is then wherever I was working for, I wanted to make sure then it would help me get my second job, and my third job, or every time you know I was gonna want to be recommend or help or given the next job from them. And I think we have done a lot with that in mentorship and in promoting and in retaining team, also members, because I feel then, you know, I'm lucky to be in this business, and it's not a business where you make a fortune, but at least you create a lot of opportunity for others. And I think I want to be able to continue to do that. And so every time I meet someone, I'm like curious to know who they are because they know me. I don't know them.
I saw it last night, you know, and it just people are, you know, I saw it in your restaurant too. You know,
but it's difficult today to sit down with every individual who worked for me
uh-huh.
and be able to know them personally.
Yeah, right.
And so I make sure that my chef keep me posted on all the new cooks coming in.
Uh-huh.
I'll make sure that the manager keep me posted on the new hire. I try to go to, you know, we always have new hire meetings where we all gather together, and I try to really be there to meet everyone. So it's a big family. I mean, in New York, we are about 800 people
wow.
working. So it's a little.
And I wanted to mention, if I mean, you obviously take mentorship and coaching and development very seriously. And for those, I guess, that don't get to know you in that context, you have this incredible book. And mm-hmm. you're probably surprised that I bought a little stack of them.
I see.
But I've been giving these away for years to young cooks and chefs in my kitchens because I think it does such a great job of kind of explaining this business. And it tells your story in a really good way. But it also, it kind of lays out things that I don't think are explained sometimes. I see myself failing to explain some of the things that are here. And now you say there's another edition? And
yes. Kind of, so okay. Letter to a Young Chef was published 15, 16 years ago. And then last year I had a new edition of it. And to that, I think I changed some of the tone of my voice, which I felt here was sometimes too harsh and too... And you know, in 15 years, a lot of evolution happened in America. I think when you see it, and I mean, you have put Baltimore on the map as a chef, and this happened in the last 15 years versus before that. Mm-hmm. And Baltimore wasn't known for food. I think
for crabs, maybe, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, for specific food. Yeah. Exactly.
Right.
And like many other cities in America. But today, I mean, I see Gavin Kaysen in Minneapolis, for example. I see what's happening in Nashville and in St. Louis and so many towns all over the country. And I think this new edition is connecting a little bit better with what's happening today. And also I invited 10 French chefs, influential chefs in America, to write a letter about a single subject. And it can be on discipline or on ingredients or creativity. Grant Achatz wrote on creativity. Gavin Kaysen on discipline, because I always felt he had good discipline. and so it's still a very relevant sort of guide to a young chef. And the last thing I want is for a young chef to read to say, I want to be a French chef. No, it's not the idea.
Right.
It don't matter what you cook, where you are from, and what is your ambition. It's, I think, just to make sure you stay connected with the expected curveball and the challenges of becoming a chef.
The curveballs will come. Are you hopeful for what comes next out there in the world with food and where we're going with?
Well, I'm very hopeful because I think you talk about Le Cirque and you talk about coming to Le Cirque. And Le Cirque was maybe the place I worked the hardest in my life. And I always tell the story, and to go home at night at the end of the day, I was living only 3 blocks away or 4 blocks away, and I will take a cab because I couldn't walk anymore. And it was a time where maybe we weren't taking care enough of the staff. We were working like animals, everyone, myself included.
Yes.
And I think today conditions are better for many. And this is for the better. I think for the better quality of food. And also what I'm hopeful is in what's happening in the last 10, 15 years in America with the younger generation of chef, who really, there is so many diverse style and yet one mission, which is to make better food in America. And I think the diversity of talent today and the diversity of food and yet this common goal, I think it's what makes this country one of the best today.
Well, I want to thank you for being a part of that effort for so long. And
yeah, bringing your own contribution too. So.
Well, this has been a thrill for me. And thanks for joining us on Origins.
Thank you, Spike.
You're very welcome. And thanks for joining us.
What I want to know your next project.
My next project right now. You know why I brought up mustard is I'm trying to figure out. What I learned about mustard is that the first mustards that kind of earned the AOC mm-hmm. in Dijon were made from verjus. And it just so happens that verjus become a really important ingredient for me. And on the other side of things, I have a couple farmers that have been growing grain. Uh-huh. And so it occurred to me to ask them if they could grow mustard seed.
I see.
And I work with some brilliant farmers, and one of them said, I think I could figure that out. And he did. And now I have the verju and I have the mustard seed, but okay. I haven't been able to make a great mustard.
Okay, let's go to Dijon together.
Okay.
Explore a couple of places who are doing still artisanal mustard.
Yes, I need to crack that code because you know that would bring two really cool ingredients together.
Mm-hmm. I believe you.
And we could do it, and maybe we could have this great mid-Atlantic mustard, and who knows.
And that's why also I think ancestral specialty like mustard was made because of the geolocation of the grain itself and the verju or the vineyards creating verju. And so I think it's very interesting for you to go back into this. So where's your verju from?
We have two vineyards, both in Maryland.
Okay.
And a few years ago, we were trying to use less citrus. And I asked them, do you know what verju is? Mm-hmm. And do you think you could make it? And it was winter. And a few months later, one of the winemakers came in with a little baggie of green grapes. And he put it on the table in the restaurant and went... and smashed it. And
your verju.
And he said, is this it? And I was like, this is it. It was sour. It was, there was virtually no sweetness yet. You know,
absolutely. Grapes.
And I said, that's it. And this past year, they made 900 gallons. And it's,
oh my God.
It's the, you know, for us, it's the principal acidifier in our cooking and in our beverage program. Mm-hmm. So
excellent. But I'm very impressed with that.
Well, that's just part of our story. But I think, you know, to what you were saying, I think where cuisine has happened in the past, and this goes back probably thousands of years now, and I was just reading that they found a piece of bread that's 14,000 years old. And it kind of turns a lot of our ideas about when agriculture started and when people started cooking with grains. Mm-hmm. It kind of upsets a lot of the theories that said that started 10,000 years ago. But anyway, I think where cuisine has happened in the past is where those ingredients and that kind of human ingenuity overlapped in a way that's
completely.
Yes.
I think it was so natural as the concept of the creation, I think became natural. And also certainly as a community also, it really were a communal work as well within that geolocation of,
and where you're from, Lyon, go back is a good example of that as anywhere on the planet, right?
Yeah, it has its share of artisanal specialty there,
but also a special climate where, you know, producing those things is possible.
Very much.
Certainly, a long tradition of farming and agriculture there that supports that incredible cuisine and makes those ingredients available, and then the culture that's built up over time. And then great chefs that come along.
Absolutely. And I think the transmission of knowledge and either in the cheese making or in many other things. And I was born and raised on the farm, and I left the farm because I didn't want to work the field and I didn't want to do what my father was doing. And I decided to become a cook. And I kind of never disconnect from the farm because I go back there with my parents and all that. But then today, of course, I will dream to have a farm again. But I will have to give up cooking, I guess.
I do think this too. We kind of think of ourselves and our restaurants as supporting farmers. But people ask all the time, you're going to start your own farm? And I'm like, no way. That's a
Well, whole- if you cannot be there every day
and
take care of it, it's very difficult. So having someone doing it, yes. Would it be just a fantasy and a dream? Yeah, but I will enjoy that. So we'll see.
Yeah. Well, I hope so. We'll call this this will be bonus content, right? And I have to thank you again for being
Thanks
here.
Thanks a lot.
It's been a great conversation.
Mike, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO on Instagram and Facebook at Full Service Radio. Thanks for listening.